Hello and welcome to the Syngene podcast. I'm Pauline Hamsey-Vinson, Interim Director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The Syngene podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. We open today's episode with Iman Kota reading from Bride of the Sea.
Hey, this is Iman Kota. I'm reading from my debut novel, Bride of the Sea. Basmala. Hannah dreams the family buries her mother, a woman they haven't seen in more than 40 years. Hannah herself hasn't seen her mom in 20 years. The family buries Sadie in view of the Red Sea, a few miles from Jeddah, where she was born. The water is a perfect, unending slab of turquoise. Hannah focuses on the horizon. The Arabian Peninsula and everything on it disappear. The land behind her, beneath her, beside her. Hannah stands on firm ground. Ahead of her, miles and miles and miles of sea. Before the burial and the sea, Hannah is in a small room with low cushions. Her mother's body lies in the middle of the floor on a sheet spread over a silk rug. Women in mourning white hunch over the body, the sleeves of their long dresses rolled to the elbows. Though she can't see their faces, Hannah knows, the way you sometimes know in dreams, who is touching her mother's lifeless skin. Hannah's grandmother, Auntie Zaranda and Riham, a handful of female cousins. They wash the hands and face three times, the arms, the feet, as though preparing the body for prayer, as though the dead could pray. They slide the washcloth down the body's right side and its left side, press the stomach with their flat palms to force a bowel movement. After they wash the body, they expertly swaddle it in white cotton, as though readying a baby for sleep. All that shows is a pale face, cheeks like crumpled sheets of unbleached paper. The women burn sandalwood incense. In real life, someone would be howling with grief, calling her mother's given name, Saida. They would call Hannah's name too, her other name, Oh Hanadi. God have mercy on your mother. God forgive her and protect her. In this dream, watery silence, as though they are at the bottom of the sea. Her mother looks harmless, quiet and still, an object. The sea becomes a great brown expansive lake, a sea again, a lake. Hannah turns from the water. Men in white thobes, brown mishlahs and white headdresses carry the body, the bundle that is her mother, down a beach that shines like a coin. The body is veiled, disguised. It could be anyone. Maybe it is not her mother. Maybe bodies have been switched. Soon the men, these uncles and cousins, both close and distant, are digging and digging, their thobes hiked up around their waists and tucked into their boxer briefs, their mishlahs and headdresses thrown into a big pile on the sand. Behind the men are waves and there is sound, a whoosh and crash and someone cussing. And though Hannah doesn't understand the Arabic words, she recognizes the tone of frustration, like someone stubbing a toe or jolting an elbow. Meanwhile, the men dig and dig and the sand won't stop filling in and the cussing continues. And the waves crash. One of the men realizes they forgot to say God's name before they started. That part, Hannah understands, a miracle of dream translation. The men put down their shovels. Together, their voices sing song and thrumming. They say, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Thank you.
Iman grew up in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Her writing has appeared in The Washington Post, USA Today, The Toast, The Establishment, Book Riot, Literary Hub, Electric Literature, and other publications. She lives with her family near Washington, D.C. Her novel, Bride of the Sea, won the Arab American National Museum Fiction Book Prize. Welcome to Sinjim, Iman. I wonder if you can start the conversation by telling us a little bit about what this novel is about and what motivated you or inspired you to write it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Bride of the Sea is my debut novel. It is about a family, a Saudi American family. The husband and wife in the family come to the United States to study in the early 70s. After they divorce, the wife decides to stay in the United States, but she is worried that her daughter is going to be taken away from her back to Saudi Arabia. So she disappears with the daughter, whose name in the book is Hanadi. The father must search for his daughter for many years. So the book is about that initial separation and then about the reunion that happens between the father and daughter, but also about the long-ranging repercussions of a family abduction and sort of how it affects both Hanadi and her parents' lives, not just when it happens, but for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, thank you for that. What made you want to focus on this theme, this idea of abduction?
So this was inspired by the story of a friend of my father's, whose daughter was abducted by his ex-wife. He didn't see her for many years. She was a child when she disappeared. And when he found her, she was an adult living in the United States. She'd lived in the United States, I think, for her entire life. You know, I'd known as a kid about this story from my parents. And I was a young adult when they were reunited. And I remember my mom telling me about it. And I just started thinking about what would that be like to be separated from a parent, to be separated from the parent's culture and country of origin, and then to be put back together with them. I just wondered what she must feel like. As I kind of explored the topic and thought about it for many years. Over that time that I was thinking about this idea, you know, a lot of novels germinate for a really long time, and this one did. And over that time, like, I became a parent and I started thinking not just about the experience of the child, but also about the experience of the two parents and the extended family. So I grew up in a very large extended family in Saudi Arabia. My dad has 11 brothers and sisters. So I had dozens of cousins, and I was really interested in exploring this idea of a really large family as opposed to this very small family unit that the parent who had abducted the child and the child would have been in. They would have been this, like, basically unit of two. The sort of scope of what I wanted to explore became bigger than just what would it be like for a child who had been kidnapped by a parent to be reunited with the other parent.
Yeah, thank you. And that sense of family really comes through in your book. There's so much of that. So many novels are about the characters, who they interact with is very limited, you know, and about their interior lives and the few characters that they interact with. But yours has a range of characters that are integral to the main characters, like the extended family comes in to play, and the dynamics of the mother's family versus the father's family and how that impacts the young daughter differently as she reunites with the families. And I thought that was very interesting and rich to have those various relationships and connections come into play.
Yeah, there are a lot of novels that have big casts of characters. Like, I think a focus in a lot of American family novels, especially over the past few decades, on small family units. And so I think it was a little bit of a risk to try to show this, like, big family canvas. I thought it was really important, especially as, like I was saying, it's a big contrast with the way they were living their life in the United States because of the action that the mother takes. So I wanted to be able to show all those characters. In earlier versions of the book, or an earlier version of the book, I had, I don't know, seven or eight points of view, because I wanted to show all these different people as I revised the book, that got culled down to the three points of view of the mother, father, and daughter. So Munir, Saida, and Hanadi, who's also known as Hannah in parts of the book. But what I tried to do was, as I was revising, to try to keep those other points of view in there in a way. So having kind of stories within stories and having a sense of this bigger picture of people who are, like, there's a chapter in the book where after Munir loses his daughter, where you get all the family members like giving him advice and telling him what to do. And that sense of my actions are not just my own, but all these people have an interest in what I do. Wanting him to get married, wanting him to sort of settle back into his life when he has this huge grief that he's living with over the loss of his daughter. And of course, no parent is going to let go of a child who has been taken away from them. Kind of getting all those voices in there was really important, because that's how I experienced Arab culture when I was growing up in Saudi Arabia. Is it was family. Even now, my dad, he still lives part of the year in Saudi Arabia. And my mom and I were recently talking about how, like, you know, he has friends, but his family is really his social network. And I think that's changed somewhat in part in the Middle East and parts of the Middle East, but it's still, I grew up with so many girls who had cousins in their class, or, you know, who were best friends with their cousins. And I think that happens in some big families in the United States too, regardless of culture, but it's something that's especially pronounced, I think, in parts of the Arab world. It was fun to try to put that on the page. And another thing that I experienced in having a big family was how there's always drama, and there's factions, and like one person's wife won't talk to somebody else's wife. And so trying to get a little bit of that in, and that was why I made the parents cousins, which is acceptable in Saudi Arabia. I have cousins who are married to each other, and having them be cousins meant that the two families were connected. And so that when the mother abducts the daughter, it has repercussions for both sides of the family. Munir and Saida's mothers are sisters. And so there's a rift between those two sisters. So that let me play around with the different dramas that happen within a family. It was a tough subject, but it was also fun to be able to write about a big family. It's not meant to be based on my family, but of course I pulled things from my experiences. And my grandmother, you know, she had 11 children, and she was married at a very young age. She was widowed at a young age, and she sort of would play favorites. I don't know. There's just ways that she was sort of this matriarch, and would kind of put her finger in things. So those kinds of things inspired me to write about the dramas of a family. You know, I don't think that I've seen a lot of books that do that. It was interesting to try to do that in a way that I think some members of an American audience, because, you know, my book was published in America, will understand those dynamics. And for other people, they'll be kind of foreign. Like, if you only have three cousins, like, you know, it might sort of be like, well, what is this about? But I think that's cool. It's cool for people to read about. I enjoy reading about things that are different from what I experienced. So, that was something that I really wanted to get on the page.
Yeah. That's really nice. And that definitely comes through, that sense of family and family dynamic as an integral part of what's going on between this couple and their child, and that sort of the very small dynamic of who gets to keep the child to the larger family dynamic, how it reverberates through that. And just briefly, do you want to explain why there's that motivation for the abduction? What's behind it? So that for readers who aren't familiar with Saudi Arabia or the custody laws, how that impacts the decision to abduct the child.
Yeah. In Saudi custody law, the And it's based on Islamic Sharia, although the Sharia gets interpreted in different ways in different parts of the Muslim world.
Right.
In Saudi custody law, a daughter will go automatically to her father when she's 7 years old. And I think that is because if the mother gets married again, it's so that she won't be in another man's household, I think. So Saida becomes concerned that when her daughter turns 7, Munir will try to take her away. I like to emphasize that, like, you know, this law exists and, you know, an abduction like this is very rare, right?
Right.
Like, but I think it's because most Saudis are living in Saudi Arabia. And so the mother will still be able to see her child. And I think in a lot of cases, the mother might actually end up keeping the child despite the laws, right? In the same way that American custody laws get interpreted and lived in a lot of different ways. Yeah. But this is meant to be a dramatization of a very extreme reaction to the laws by a person who isn't making good choices, right? And that was something that it took a while to kind of get the nuances of that character right. I still get a lot of people who don't understand why she does what she does. I think that that's okay because a lot of times people in real life do things that we're like, why did that person do that? Why did they have that extreme reaction to that thing? And it makes sense to that person, but it doesn't make sense to anybody else. Readers are going to have to just sort of feel like, oh, this person is reacting in a way that most of us wouldn't. Now what happens, you know?
Right. So that was another interesting thing reading your book is that a lot of times the sympathy is generated for the mother who does something like that. And reading it as a reader, I got the sense of a lot of sympathy for the father, the struggles that he went through to be separated from his daughter in this way, and for the daughter to be separated from her culture in that way and her family in that way, and not to sort of be like, oh, this woman had to do it to save her daughter. No, it was sort of always a kind of a, why is she doing this? And the effects of that, which I thought was a thoughtful way of dealing with this issue.
Yeah, I think you're right that portraying this situation goes against what a lot of us want to sympathize with the mother. And especially when you're talking about an Arab family, mm-hmm. Arab fathers don't get a lot of sympathy in American culture. Anyways, I felt like I was kind of pushing against the grain, but I read about family abduction and I read some really powerful personal narratives by people who had survived family abductions. One of the misconceptions about family abduction is that as long as the child is with someone who they're related to, they're okay because this person cares about them. But actually, family abduction is a huge trauma for a lot of people who experience it. And there are often lies and a lot of moving around and instability that go with it. And so I wanted to try to portray that honestly. Some of the people whose narratives I read, they didn't realize they were kidnapped until they were older. And then they had to like sort of totally reconstruct their memories of their childhoods and what certain things had meant and what they believed to be true about what had happened when they were children. And that's something that for Hanadi in the book never goes away, right? I think there were readers who kind of wanted a sort of for Hanadi and her mother to kind of reconcile and get over it. And I won't spoil it for people who haven't read the book, but I wanted to tread carefully there because I think that may happen for some people, but it doesn't happen for everyone who's kidnapped by a family member. And so I wanted to think about how these things reverberate across the years. So in the beginning, when I first started writing the book, I was really focused on the reunion mm-hmm. and when Hanadi and her father meet and how he finds her. And as I kept writing the book, I realized that that one moment happens, but then you have the rest of your life mm-hmm. right in front of you. And anybody who's been through kind of a difficult experience, it often doesn't just affect us at that moment that it happens, but it affects us for the rest of our lives in small ways and sometimes in large ways. And so that's why I decided to kind of expand the amount of time that the book covered from what is it like to be reunited to what is it like to be taken away, reunited, and then to continue your relationships with your family members over decades. If the book was going to follow that amount of time, then there were certain sort of historic moments in time for Arab Americans that I wanted to touch on. So the Gulf War, 9/11 is not a huge focus of the book. It's kind of skipped over, but you get the sense that it's happened, right? And to sort of show that here is a person who's been taken away from her culture. She returns to it, and then she has this sort of relationship to her country that has changed at a time when the country's relationship to her and the community that she's a part of, whether she really knows it or not, is changing, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I love the way you put that switch that happens from her perspective, how she is regarded in the United States, how she sees herself, how others see her, how she sees Saudi Arabia, and how she's seen there and by her family. So that's, those are really nice little touchstones that you have in that book. And that also brings us to the question of narrative style. You start in 2018 and then with a dream that Hanadi has, and then you go back to 1970. As a reader, I really appreciated the years, the markings at the different sections, because it kept me anchored. And of course, there were all these details about looking up at a telephone book. You know, what would it mean to
oh, yeah.
You know, things like that? How would you find someone, you know, when we're not looking at Google Maps?
Right.
So those details were really beautiful to notice throughout and how they change, you know, that very much capturing the different time periods and the experience in those different time periods, as well as the experience in the different places where, like, the cold in Ohio and the heat in Saudi Arabia, but also that it's not all desert in Saudi Arabia, right? You make a strong point about that. And that takes us through that. And then it takes us back to 2018 again. So do you want to talk a little bit about that opening chapter, the dream that Hanadi has?
Yeah, I wrote that early on. And I think it wasn't always a dream, but I had some early readers who were just like, the tone of this is so different. Can't mix these two tones. I had always thought about this story as being kind of in conversation with the story of Yusuf in the Quran. So if people don't know that story, Yusuf is Joseph, and he is one of Jacob's children. Jacob has 12 children, but two of them are from a different mother, Joseph and his brother. And there's jealousy between the children of one mother and the other. In the Quran, he has dreams and he interprets other people's dreams, and he is taken away from his family. So his jealous siblings throw him in a well, fake his death, and his father grieves him for years. Meanwhile, Yusuf has this whole other life in Egypt, right? Interpreting dreams, and he's eventually reunited with his family. So it was sort of like, well, why not make this a dream? There's whole conversations like on literary Twitter about whether, you know, dreams are a total no-no in books. And, you know, they can be kind of overused. But I felt like because dreams are a part of the story of Yusuf in the Quran, there was a way that I wanted to use dreams as part of the religious fabric of the book. In the Quran, dreams always come true. You just have to know how to analyze them. Yusuf has the ability to do that, to tell people what their dreams mean, and then their dreams come true. In real life, that's not what happens. So in the Quran, they're like a narrative device, right? So for me, this dream that she has is about her subconscious trying to interpret the future and understand who she is. It's telling her things that she doesn't always realize she's thinking about. And it's kind of showing how her relationship to that culture of the family is not always clear to her. There were times when I was like, ugh, is nobody going to want to publish this book if I start it with a dream? Oh. But I felt like I had a really clear reason in my own mind for starting it that way. People also talk about not having prologues. And so I didn't call it a prologue, but I think that I love a really good prologue, a really good opening section that gives you like a little snippet of something. And then you have the whole rest of the book to figure out what it means, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I also love epigraphs. And the epigraph of the book is from the Quran. And it's from the story of Joseph, from Surah Yusuf, we do tell you the best of stories. I love that line. And then there's the story of Joseph having this dream about his siblings and his father telling him, don't tell this story. And so it wasn't until I like put that epigraph in the front of my book that I read it. And I thought, there's a contradiction here. What stories are we allowed to tell and which stories are we not allowed to tell? That's a huge theme of the book, is secrets and lies and the stories we tell ourselves. The dream fits into that whole theme of dreams are stories. Are these stories that we want to reveal to other people or stories that we're going to keep to ourselves?
That's very powerful. Yeah. I enjoyed having the opening chapter be somewhat setting the mood for this whole thing, and that sets the relationship between the daughter and the mother very clearly and the displacement that happens. And so all that is captured in just like, I'm looking at it here, 1, 2, 3, less than 3 pages, really. Then we have the whole novel to flesh it out and carry it through. So that was very nice. Let's talk a little bit. You've mentioned it a few times, and it's a prominent theme throughout the novel, is the aspect of religion. In many ways, it's a literary motif that goes through the novel, where a lot of references are to Islamic traditions and religious practices. And in some ways, it's just a part of the fabric of the everyday life of these characters, because they happen to be Muslim. There's also part of it as if you are almost illustrating this life and its richness and multifaceted aspect of it to your reader, who may or may not know enough about it or have misconceptions about it. So do you want to speak to both the how religion is infused throughout the novel, and also maybe a little bit about how that works for your audience and what audience you had in mind?
Yeah. You know, when I was growing up in Saudi Arabia, like, we prayed 5 times a day. We stopped at school. We prayed. My school had a little like musalli, and there were several teachers who would lead us in prayer and during dhuhr. There's a story about myself and my sort of integrating into Saudi society. I was born there, but then we lived in the US. And when I first moved there, I was 8. And my mom was finishing her nursing degree. My dad took me and dropped me off on my first day at school. I had prayed with my dad before, but I had never been at a school where in the middle of the day, they would put these mats on the floor and in the middle of the courtyard, and everybody was praying together. I get in there and I pray with everybody. I was wearing the wrong uniform. And one of the teachers, or maybe it was the headmistress, came to me afterwards and was like, you need to bring a scarf with you tomorrow and wear a scarf on your head when you pray and cover your arms. Because the person who taught me my faith was my dad, and he's a guy. And so he didn't tell me to cover my hair when I prayed. And he didn't send me to school with a prayer scarf. Yeah. So that was sort of my first day of school. It was about religion. It was about prayer. It was about fitting in and doing it the right way. And it's not just Saudi language, the way that we talk about things. God is in everything. And so to me, it felt really important to make that part of the book. But I think that religion is also part of the book in terms of the modes of storytelling, like we were talking about, and using things like dreams and having a conversation with stories from the Quran. And so it's not just about daily ritual, and it's not just about faith, but it's also about like the wholeness of the religion and all of the ways that it enriches lives, but also complicates lives, right? I've written about this in an essay about how I felt like religion needed to be part of my Saudi American novel, but I don't think that a Saudi novel or a Saudi film has to be explicitly about religion, right?
Right.
But for me, it was important to do that. An example I have of that is in the movie Wejda, which is about a Saudi girl who wants a bicycle. It's by the filmmaker Haifa Mansour. She enters a Quran recitation contest in order to win the money to buy the bike. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. Because I, as a child, was in a Quran recitation contest that was sponsored by like the Department of Education or something like that. And I went to the headquarters and I read the Quran and I answered questions about the meanings of words. I don't think I won anything. So it felt really true to me.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also was in a contest where when I was in high school or middle school, where we had to write about a different country and research it. And I wrote about Japan. And so you're making choices, right? You can, you can choose the religious thing or you can choose the non-religious thing. Yeah. And it might depend on your audience or it might depend on the kind of story you want to tell. So I was making those choices that I was going to show people praying. I was going to show the people who don't pray also.
Yeah.
And I was going to show how there's a scene where Hanadi, who's not grown up being taught how to pray, tries to pray and she's kind of conflicted about it, but it's like the thing that she needs to do at that moment. And that's contrasted with scenes where her father is praying and he has this like really deep belief in his faith. So I thought that using those contrasts would show how religion plays out differently for different people. You asked about audience. I've seen that for some readers, it's all new and they're seeing it. It's sort of enriching for them to see how faith was practiced in Saudi Arabia during the time that, you know, is covered in the book. And then other readers who have not seen the Islamic faith portrayed that way in Anglophone literature before, and really Muslim readers or Arab readers who've told me that, wow, this is the first book that really portrayed that experience that I have had something similar to, even if they're not Saudis, you know, also the way it portrays family. Someone said the way it portrays Shisha, you know, and so I like to think that different people are going to get different things out of it. And I guess a novelist can't try to change people's minds, right? So if someone has like sort of Islamophobic feelings about Islam, this may not be, you know, the right book for them. I don't think that one book is going to change someone's mind. You know, maybe sometimes people have life-changing experiences with books, but I tend to think that it's like an accumulation of things over time. I don't think that it's my job to worry about that. My job as a novelist is to tell the story that I want and in some ways need to tell, and to tell it using the tools that I think will best tell that story. And so in this story, it was telling a story about faith. The book that I'm working on now also involves some conversion, but it's not about faith in the same way. It's not about religion in the same way. I'm really interested in how people experience faith. Mm. And I tell people when I'm talking about, I've given workshops on writing characters, and I tell people, give your characters beliefs, give them faith. Like, even if it isn't religious belief, what do they believe in? What is the thing that is their pillar of belief? It could be free speech, you know, it could be the absence of God. Nobody's faith is completely set in stone. And I think it's really interesting to investigate how different events and the passage of time and different things influence how people experience their faith in certain things, and vice versa, how faith makes us react to certain things, right? I'd love to see more books that directly deal with that theme and that topic.
Right. It definitely comes through as a part of the characterization of Munir that he has this faith. At one point, he tells his friend, correct me if I'm misremembering, we don't believe in coincidence, right? So it's like everything is like a maktub, right?
Right, right.
So there's that underlying aspect to him. And it's just how he operates. Also interesting to see that the other characters don't necessarily have the same predisposition.
The same worldview, right?
Worldview, that he does.
And that it makes certain things come into conflict with each other.
Right. Yeah. That was great to see and very, very nicely done. And some books can sound very didactic. Your book avoids that, even though it's really showing how something is, but it doesn't have like, now I'm going to teach you how.
Right.
So I'm impressed how you're able to put that as part of the characterization, part of the worldview, part of the social network and the fabric of the novel and the family dynamics. So that was really nice to see. Another theme that I saw in your novel is this whole thing about newspapers and newspaper reporting and the relationship that Munir has with his father-in-law. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as we wrap up our discussion? And maybe we can bring in that aspect of things.
That's another sort of thing that people say is like, why do so many writers make their characters writers? And you should give them other jobs. I think especially in talking about Saudi Arabia, I felt like it was a good occupation for him to have to kind of show the stories we're allowed to tell and the stories that we're not allowed to tell. If you want to pick a thing that's happening in the Arab world, something related to Saudi Arabia or even like Egypt, reading about the Sharm el-Sheikh climate convention and like reading American papers about it. And then I tried to look up what English language Egyptian papers were saying about Alaa Abd al-Fattah and stuff like that. And it's like completely different. And that happens when American newspapers are talking about Saudi Arabia, and I'll go to like Saudi Gazette or Arab News, and they're saying things in a different way. I grew up reading the English language newspapers in Saudi Arabia. I didn't really read the Arabic language newspapers. So I grew up reading Saudi Gazette and Arab News, the actual paper newspapers. One of them was green. The other one was white. And I actually know people whose families are in the news business in Saudi Arabia. A number of years ago, there was like a New Yorker article about a newsroom in Saudi Arabia. And I wanted to explore the ways that a guy who is dedicated to journalism has to navigate the things that he is allowed to write about and the things that he is not. And it's not really throughout the whole book, but a section where he is searching for his daughter and searching for the truth there, he's also becoming a journalist in Saudi Arabia and searching and learning what he's allowed to say and not say there, right? So these two things are kind of happening at the same time. When I was living in Jeddah during the Gulf War, it was a really interesting time in terms of news, because what was happening was the Saudi news outlets could not report about what was happening, but everybody was listening to the BBC. So everybody was talking about what was happening behind closed doors. They were getting their news from somewhere. And then when the Americans came in and when Operation Desert Storm happened, they were playing CNN all the time on the Saudi channels. Mm-hmm. So we were getting our news about what was happening in our country from America. We were getting Wolf Blitzer, you know?
Oh, no.
It was crazy. And the book doesn't go so much into what was happening with the news during that time, but that was on my mind. And thinking about the way that the American media covered that war, a lot of it was total propaganda, right? And so I'm thinking about the truths we can tell and the way that Americans kind of view truth-telling in Saudi Arabia as sort of non-existent, but also like knowing there are different expectations on journalists there than here. But we also, you know, our news is completely filtered and it's hard to find good, actually objective news about the Middle East in the United States. Those are things that were on my mind. So I don't think they're completely explored in the book, but that's sort of maybe an explanation of why I wanted him to be a journalist.
Yeah.
And then why I wanted the father-in-law to also be a journalist is sort of similar, that they have a little bit different points of view on the truth, especially when it comes to the disappearance of Hanadi and the father-in-law's daughter, who is Hanadi's mother. And so to have these two newsmen in conflict with each other was interesting to me. You know, I kind of wanted to get like a little a little mini history of journalism in the Arabian Peninsula and throughout the Arab world. Newspapers, I think, were a really important part of anti-colonialism and nationalism. And so, again, it's not a huge part of the book, but all things that I think about a lot is, where have we come from? Newspapers were affiliated with certain movements, kind of giving a little bit of a nod to the news people of the region, and giving them a role in my book was kind of a fun thing to do.
Yeah. I appreciated that aspect of it. And I appreciated the way you drew a parallel between, you know, there's active censorship on the one hand in Saudi Arabia, but there's also all sorts of, as you put it, propaganda in American newspapers that people don't even realize is such, as it's unacknowledged or a sort of goes below the surface of what kind of news we get. It is very filtered news from a very specific perspective often.
Right.
So that was nice to see in that novel too. There's a lot more in this novel that we could talk about, and I don't want to give it away for the readers. So I would encourage you to explore it, because there are other things like incarceration and other things like that that you talk about in different ways and very interesting ways in this novel, that I'm going to leave it to the readers to discover those as they come upon them, because that was part of my experience as a reader to see those developments was part of the enjoyment of reading a long text. A novel can cover so much and different threads. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed it. Yeah. Is there anything that you wanted to say that you didn't have a chance to say?
It's been a pleasure to be here. And I love the fact that people can listen to this and then listen to conversations with other Arab American writers and kind of hear our different takes on things, because sort of one of my big things is we need more books. This is one book about a Saudi American experience, and it's not the final word about anything. And none of the wonderful Arab American books is, but they're part of this beautiful mosaic that we're building to tell a story about this sort of multifaceted community. I love being able to bring in the stories of Saudis in America, because Saudis have a very different history here than other Arabs from other countries of origin do. The more stories that we have, the more full a picture and more beautiful a picture we'll have.
Yeah, thank you for that. I appreciate that, and I agree with it fully. Yes, thank you again.
Today's episode was hosted by Pauline Homsey-Vincent. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Asma Baban, and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdul Haq. Scene Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Scene Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, scenegmpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.